There are three readings tonight. The first one is taken from Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 31, and can be found on page 2 in the Bibles. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. And now, if you turn over to page 4, the second reading is Genesis 3, verses 17 to 19. And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And then the final one is Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 18 to 26, and that's found on page 668. "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind."
Thanks very much, John, for not just one reading, but for three. And thanks everyone else for, hopefully, many of us have been reading Ecclesiastes over this last week. And if you haven't started yet, my challenge to you for this little series of four in Ecclesiastes, it's a book that needs to be at least as much experienced as preached on. And I've been experiencing it as I've toiled with my toil under the sun in my study. But hopefully, many of you are having the same kind of experience. I know some of you have because you've asked me what particularly difficult verses mean, and I don't know. But do keep reading it. See if you can have read the whole thing by the time we get there at the end of a couple weeks' time. I'm also wearing my Ecclesiastes themed T-shirt today. It's a present from my mother, and it says "knowledge" in kind of yellow writing here. And the word "knowledge" is kind of floating in the sky. And I thought that was a pretty good summary, because we've seen in Ecclesiastes that knowledge is pretty hard to grasp at. It's like a kind of cloudy thing that you can't quite get through your fingers. If you were here last week, you'll know that we saw that Ecclesiastes begins and ends with the theme word. It's in verse 2 of chapter 1. And in the ESV, it's translated vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And then the preacher's message is summed up at the end of the book in chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So that's what the book's about, obviously. It's about all being vanity. Except we saw last week that the word vanity is perhaps not the best translation of the word in Hebrew, hebel, which he is going on about. Because everything is not vain. Everything is not purposeless. As we read through Ecclesiastes, we find lots of so that, or in order that, or here is the conclusion or the purpose of things. Things are not without purpose in Ecclesiastes' thinking. Another translation, the New International Version that I often use at home, meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher. Everything is meaningless. But we saw last week that's not quite right either, because there is a meaning to things, which I guess is why we've got 12 chapters of someone telling us where he got to as he began to explore wisdom and try and understand. He says various things. I came to understand, or I came to perceive, or I came to know that such and such. It's not without meaning. It's not without purpose. It's just that the meaning and that the purpose that there are a little bit beyond us. They're hard to grasp. They're hard to completely get. And the literal meaning of that word is fog or vapour. Vapour of vapours, says the preacher. Fog of fogs. Mist of mists. Everything is mist, like my little floaty, cloudy knowledge on my T-shirt. It's not that there's no meaning there, but good luck if you try to get to the bottom of it by yourself, because you won't manage to. You remember I shared last week but my favourite verse, or at least the most fitting to my experience of trying to preach on this book verse, in chapter 7. I said in my heart, I'll be wise, but it was beyond me, that which is as far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? Like fog, you can't grasp it. You can't see clearly through it, which is why you drive slowly and turn on your fog lights. Like fog, it doesn't stay around for very long. Everything seems so fleeting. Life is so short. A time of joy is replaced so quickly with a time of sorrow. And just like fog, remember we had the image last week of a little schoolboy trying to catch some fog in a jar. And you wake up the next morning, you find it's gone. All you've got is a damp jar. And so much in life is like that. It's beyond your understanding. It's beyond your ability to keep hold of it. It's foggy, misty, and vapour. And we saw last week that the aim of the preacher in some ways is to humble us. Yes, it's true that we can know so much as Christians, but we can't know everything. And often our experience will be of confusion and vexation, of holding our hands up and saying, I just don't get it. And Ecclesiastes is saying, that's right. God has made it that way. That is the kind of humility before him that we should have. Now, I said last week that it might help, particularly in those times in life where really things don't make any sense. So a loved one gets a diagnosis from the doctor and it's cancer. And you're there on your knees in the evening and you say, look, Lord, why would you do this? This makes no sense to me. Or you go in to get called into the office to see your boss and he tells you that they're letting you go. Just as you were beginning to have these fantastic opportunities to talk about Jesus. And you go, why? Doesn't make any sense. There are those moments in life where we feel, I can't get to the bottom of what God's doing here. But I had a helpful chat with Matt Banks in the week, and he said, yeah, Andrew, but isn't it just not in the extreme cases, but just in every day that Ecclesiastes is saying it's beyond us? The fantastic time you have with a friend that you just has to come to an end because it's time to go home. And you think, if only that evening could have lasted forever, but now it's gone. Or that wistfulness as you just open the metro one day and you just read some newspaper stories and you think, well, life is so beautiful in London and it's so ugly in London. I can't make sense of it, this mixture of happiness and pain, just in everything. And I think that's right. Here is a book for every moment of every day where it tells us that everything is vapour. Now, we're going to try and focus in on three different themes in our remaining time in the book. Today we're looking at the theme of toil and enjoyment. Next week, the theme of death. So do come back. It's going to have some hope in it as well. Please come back next week. And the last week, the theme of fear. I think last week I was so confused, I didn't even know which themes we were going to do. But those are the three. And so today we're looking at the theme of work and enjoyment, toil and enjoyment. And if you look down the handout, which we have one this week, we're making a little bit of progress. And I want to start off by introducing you to the philosophy of existentialism. I'm going to start that by reading you a quote from another summer reading suggestion, if you haven't read it yet. The Universe Next Door by James Sayre. This is his quote from Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist. It's pretty depressing. Every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Kind of happy, kind of start to a book. I leaned back and closed my eyes. The images forewarned immediately leapt up and filled my closed eyes with existences. I knew it was the world, the naked world, suddenly revealing itself. And I choked with rage at this gross, absurd being. Existentialism is basically saying that the world has no meaning. It's no purpose. It's pointless. And yet if you want to go through a day of your life, you've got to kind of create some kind of meaning. It's the best that you can do is to try and kind of make up some reason for doing stuff. Try and hold on to some kind of values that make life worth living, that make one day better than the next. And so in existentialism, you're encouraged to kind of try and create a meaning for yourself, knowing that at rock bottom there really isn't any kind of meaning. And so I guess in our society it comes often in the kind of form of hedonism, just living for enjoyment. There's no point in anything because we're all going to die and the earth is going to crash into the sun and for millions of years there'll be nothing. So there's no point, I know that, but I might as well kind of be happy, might as well have fun, might as well be thought well of by my friends, and I sort of create some kind of meaning in what is basically a purposeless world. Now, some people think that Ecclesiastes is a bit like an existentialist. So he says, you know, there's no meaning, there's no purpose, everything's totally confusing. So we might as well just make do. We might as well just eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's the existentialist slogan. And some people think it's Ecclesiastes' slogan. I want to show you that it isn't. That Ecclesiastes is a Christian writer, not an existentialist one, and that his understanding, even though he's looking through misted up, foggy glasses, is profoundly shaped by some of the big truths of the Bible. In other words, even in his confusion, his vexation, there's certain truths that he knows from his Bible that help him to steer a course between the cat's eyes with his fog lights on. And the two truths are that the world has been created good by a loving God, and that world has been cursed by a God who is angry at human rebellion. The world has been created, as we've been singing about, thinking about all evening, and that the world has been cursed. And those are two profoundly biblical truths that are there all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. First of all, the world's been created. Well, everywhere when he speaks about God, it's clear that God is the one who made everything, the one who controls everything. He speaks about God as a creator in chapter 12. He speaks as the God who made everything in chapter 11. And he recalls that reading we heard from Genesis, right at the beginning of the Bible, that tells us that everything that exists came about by the design of a good God. God said one day, let there be light. And millions of stars came into existence. That's why there's a sun up in the sky. And God said, let's separate the earth from the water. And that is why there is a land mass and sea level and hasn't swamped all the mountains. The way that the world is owes its existence to a good creator. But also the world that God made in Genesis is a good world. A fundamentally fantastic world. It doesn't just have light and darkness and seas and land. It has blessing. God makes man his image, and he blesses man and tells man and woman to fill the earth and subdue it. And God sees that what he's made is very good. So the Christian is not an existentialist. Here we are in a meaningless, accidental world. Ecclesiastes is not an existentialist. Ecclesiastes believes that God made everything that we see around us. That everything was designed by a God who wanted to bless us and make it a joy. And in particular, that work was a blessing. Just keep a finger in Ecclesiastes, because it's a very difficult book to find again if you lose it. And turn back to Genesis chapter 1 to that reading. Page 2 of the Bible. And just notice that the business of being in charge of the world, of having dominion over the world, of working to control the world, is a good thing. So look at verse 28. God just made man and woman. Verse 28, God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heaven, every living thing that moves on the earth. So controlling the world, ruling the world, eating food from the world, from the green trees that God's given, all the plants God's given, going around instructing the animals, being kind of glorified zookeepers in the world. There's work to do, and it's a blessed work, and it's very good. So the reality of working life, created by God, and very good to do. But there's another perspective alongside that in Ecclesiastes, which is the recognition that the world that's been created so good has gone so wrong. Now, when Richard was introducing the confession this evening, he said that God had made everything in the world good, and that we were the ones who'd stuffed everything up. And that's true. Everything began to go wrong when a man and woman refused to live in God's world, trusting him, honouring him, obeying him. That was when everything began to go wrong. But it's not just wrong because of the things that we've stuffed up. It's also wrong because of the curse that God has pronounced on the world in his judgment on our stuffing it up. Even the good God who made this world perfect, in his anger at our rebellion and our evil, has imposed a penalty of curse on the world. And that was our second reading in Genesis chapter 3. God says to the man, cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. You shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken. You were dust, and to dust you will return. A world created and yet cursed. And you see that perspective also in Ecclesiastes. Look, for example, at chapter 3, verse 20, page 669. Page 669, all go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Exact quotation, pretty much, from Genesis chapter 3. Ecclesiastes knows about the curse that God imposed on creation. Or Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 13. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Notice that. I think that's a very striking verse. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? God has twisted the world himself, and no one can unravel it. And why has he done that? He's done that in his judgment at human beings for failing to love him, trust him, obey him. And so here is a strange kind of dichotomy at the heart of human existence, that we live in a world that's full of beauty and goodness and joy and happiness. because God has blessed it and made it good. And we live in a world that's full of sadness and vexation and futility and pain. Because we messed it up. And in his anger, God judged and cursed the world. And our experience, recognizes Ecclesiastes, is shaped by both of those realities. We live in a world that's created, and yet in a world that is cursed because of sin. And I think it's that combination of the two that gives poignancy to our experience. If everything that ever happened to you from the very second you were born was only miserable pain, well, that would be pretty grim, wouldn't it? But there wouldn't be poignancy. It would just be life would be just not worth living. You prefer to die instantly if you had the choice. Everyone would commit voluntary suicide. The world isn't like that. It's not as bad as it could be. It's that mixture of joy and beauty that makes every day of life worth grabbing and enjoying. And yet the pain and the frustration and the despair that makes you sometimes wonder if it is worth living. And Ecclesiastes understands that in terms of these two great truths, that God made the world good and that we stuffed it up, and so God cursed the world in judgment. And so all I want us to see is a little look through the foggy windscreen with those sets of cat's eyes in our mind. Those are the guidelines, but now we can understand something of the experience that Ecclesiastes sees. And so firstly, accept with respect to your work the God-imposed frustration of fog. Accept the God-imposed frustration of foggy work. And you can see, maybe you can resonate this with what you're going to experience tomorrow morning as you go to the office or to college or wherever you're off to. Chapter 2, verse 18. I hope it's not quite this bad for you. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing as I must leave it to the man who'll come after me. It makes me wonder whether he'd fallen out with his son at this point. You know, and the thing that really annoys him isn't just that it's pointless, but that he's got to leave it all to someone who's a complete idiot. Verse 19. Who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool? Maybe the son's just come back with his school report or something. And is it really going to be worth it? But the point is, again, it's the fogginess of work. Nothing lasts. Yeah, so you build up this great security in the bank, and then you die, and half of it goes to inheritance tax, and who knows whether the government that's next will be wise or be a fool, and the other half goes to your children. Who knows whether they'll spend it wisely or stupidly? But the point is that you can't keep it. One of those properties that we saw of fog, it doesn't last. So verse 20, I turned about, gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who didn't toil for it. This is vanity, this is mist, and a great evil. What does a man gain? What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? All his days are full of sorrow. His work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart doesn't rest. This also is fog. If that is your experience tomorrow morning at work, I hope it isn't, but if it is, and there are days when it will be, understand that this is not the world that God originally wanted it to be. This is not the perfect world that God created. This is the cursed world because of the terrible evil of rebellion against him. And so even as you're dealing with an inbox that's thousands of pages long, and the scroll bar is only one pixel wide because there's so many of them, think to yourself, this is a world that's turned its back on God. That is why my work is so vexing and toilsome today. Chapter 3, verse 9. What does the man gain from his toil? That is the question, isn't it? What's the point of this? Or chapter 5, verse 13. There's a grievous evil I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture, and his father was son, but has nothing in his hand.
As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again. Naked as he came, and he shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? That's a reminder, isn't it? If you're getting at that stage of being ultra super ambitious as a lawyer, and they're saying to you, please work 25 hours in the day, because they do law and not maths, and they seem to think this is reasonable, and you're thinking, maybe it's worth it, because I could be partner, I could be Uber partner, I could be Uber rich, and then just think of how much someone cares what level you got to in the law firm on the day that you're in a little wooden box. It doesn't matter. And then remember that the ultimate end to your ambitions are imposed by God, who has cursed the world because of our sin. It's a cursed, created world that we live in. But I think that's the Ecclesiastes that we all expected. When I said, can I preach on Ecclesiastes, and we knew it was going to come right on the end of, hot on the heels of Judges, I think we thought that it might push us all over the edge, kind of one depressing book after another. And so we got William to do his little series on joy in the middle, and the hope of kind of raising our spirits enough to weather it. But I said at the time, I wonder whether Ecclesiastes is not only depressing. He does see that this is a world under judgment of God. But nonetheless, this is a world that God blessed and made good. And some of the jewels and the wonder of his creation still shines through. And so if you're going to understand work tomorrow morning, you don't need to only understand that this world is cursed. We need to remember that this world is created. It's the created cursed world. And Ecclesiastes has both perspectives. And the thing that really strikes me is that almost every miserable toil verse that you can find in Ecclesiastes has right next to it an enjoyment because God has given you blessing verse. Almost always, there's both. I can give you a selective reading like that, which sounds very grumpy and annoyed. But always alongside of it, there's suddenly a chin-up verse where you remember that God is good and he blesses you and gives you enjoyment. I just want us to get a feel for that. And so I've asked Richard to read the grumpy half, just because I'm fed up with doing the grumpy bits. And I'm going to read the joyful bits that come right next door in Ecclesiastes. And just so you get something of the effect of hearing it. So, Richard, it's over to you in your grumpiest possible voice to start.
Here we go. For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart doesn't rest. This is vanity.
There's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or drink or have enjoyment?
What gain has the worker from his toil?
I perceive there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man.
This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the winds? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger.
Behold, what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life God's given him. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God. For he won't much remember the short days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. And for the last one, we get to switch over. So I'm happy first and then in comes Richard being a bit grumpy. Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. For God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife you love all the days of your life that he's given you under the sun. Because that's your portion in life, in your toil at which you toil under the sun.
Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there's no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going.
Thank you, Richard. Now, we laugh and we smile. But do you hear those perspectives side by side? I don't think this is Ecclesiastes the schizophrenic. I don't think he's confused. I think this is Ecclesiastes, the man who has grasped the two truths that explain together our experience. And God is the giver of good gifts and enjoyment in your toil. You go to work tomorrow, sometimes things in the office are going to be fun. And you're going to be paid a salary and you can use that to buy food and some of that food will be enjoyable to eat. You might enjoy it for a summer holiday, that will be great fun. And recognise those things are the gift of a good God to you. The blessings of his creation that still shine through. But then you'll find that sometimes work is burdensome and toilsome. And you'll be saving for a pension and the pension will be wiped out in a crunch. Or you'll be building up a home that you don't get to enjoy because you get a diagnosis early from the doctor. And it seems foggy and you can't see very far. And Ecclesiastes says, to be wise is to know both. To understand God's gift of enjoyment and to thank him for it and to enjoy it. Man can do no better than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in his work. But also to understand that this is a world under judgment that God has cursed. And so toil will never ultimately satisfy in the way that we were made for. Just quickly, why I think we need the two. I think you need the two so that work doesn't become everything to you. Let's suppose you get the eat and drink and find enjoyment in his work only. It's pretty difficult to do that from Ecclesiastes, but just imagine you manage to snip out all the really happy verses and you say, I'm a Christian and God's given me my job and so I'm going to be as ambitious as I can and do everything for my work and that will be my ultimate satisfaction. And God has ensured that it won't be. Got lots of ways of doing that. Broken photocopiers, lost emails, sackings, doctors. Lots of ways of being sure. And recognise that now. This is not a world anymore where working is going to be the ultimate satisfaction. This is a world that is broken. This is a world that God has made crooked. And ultimately, only the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ will make it straight again. Until the problem of our rebellion against God and his curse on our rebellion is finally fixed, work will never be ultimately satisfying. On the other hand, I think, and this is maybe where it speaks to some of us regulars at St. Helens, we kind of got that in our head. We know that God's cursed the world. We know that he's not going to fix the world until Jesus comes back and takes us to the new creation. And so we're prepared for the next 20, 30, 40 years of grumpiness, waiting for Jesus to come back. And Ecclesiastes says that's wrong as well. This is not a world where all the beauty of work has been snuffed out completely. This is not a world that's as bad as it could be, where no work has any value. But recognize that the value that there is in the work is a gift. It's enjoyment from the hand of God. He's given, and a foretaste of the new creation, and where everything, once again, that God's made will be very good. I think sometimes we can easily be down on work. Work's pointless, the world's pointless, let's wait for Jesus to come back. Or we can sometimes be heard to be down on secular work. You know, say, obviously, if you're a vicar, that's very joyful and worthwhile. But if you have to do anything else, I'm sorry, that's obviously just pointless and part of the fall. That's not what Ecclesiastes is saying. He says God's made work to be a good thing, a blessed thing, an enjoyable thing from the hand of God. But he's cursed the world for its rebellion against him. And only the good news of Jesus Christ will straighten that out. And so my challenge to you is to go into this week at work with those two perspectives in your head. When you enjoy something, thank God for it because it's a gift from him as your good creator. And when you hate something, just reflect on how wretchedly twisted this world has become because of our rebellion against God. And look forward to the day that he will sort it out through his gospel. Let's pray. What does a man gain from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? All his days are full of sorrow. His work is a vexation.
There's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or drink or have enjoyment? Heavenly Father, we pray for us ourselves this week as we go to work in a world that you have created so good, and yet because of our rebellion against you, you have cursed in judgment. Father, help us to take enjoyment in everything that's good and to praise you as the giver, the creator of all good things. And Father, in the things that are vexing and futile, help us to look to you as the one who one day, through Jesus Christ, will have mercy on us and will remake the world as a perfect world and will reverse the effects of the fall and will remove the curse that you have cursed this world with. Father, help us to work as those who put our trust in Jesus, who put our hope in the new creation, and yet who are quick to thank you for the blessings that you give us, even now, as we strive for our food. We pray these things, Father, for Jesus' sake. Amen.